This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
By Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, pensions, investments, wills, that sort of thing, and the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce. Chambers of Commerce?
Is it chamber? No, we are just chamber. One chamber, yep.
And I'm joined by Christian Spence.
Hello, Christian.
Hello.
And Alex Davis.
Hello.
So I'll just kick this off. We have a deal-ish.
Yeah.
Go on, Alex.
When was this? Was it Monday?
I think this was Monday. There was surprise announcement. Yeah, we weren't expecting anything. There was kind of some rumours flying around in the Sunday press, and then all of a sudden it was like stand by for a press conference on Monday morning, and Barnier and Davis were there, and basically we have the outline of a transition deal.
Wow. Well, why was it so secret?
Good question. I think probably because by the sounds of it, they were still agreeing and redrafting it early on Monday morning.
Yeah, it was odd. I read somewhere that before Monday morning or Sunday evening or something like that, the two hadn't actually seen each other in real life for 4 months.
That's right, yeah. Davies hasn't been getting involved in his hands. He's left it to the civil servants, which seems to show if you get David Davies out of the way, things happen.
That is quite sensible.
Yeah, it is, exactly. You can't expect the Secretary of State to do all of that work. That's what your officials are there for.
Yeah. So we've got a draft transition arrangement agreement. It's not all agreed though. It's colour coded.
We've gone from red, white, and blue
to
green, yellow, and white. Yeah.
Yeah. So. So it's three colours, yeah. Green is things where we have complete agreement. Some people have put it as green are areas where there's been complete capitulation. We have yellow, which are areas where some things still need to be ironed out, or areas where we are just negotiating our capitulation. And then white are things which still need to be discussed.
You're becoming a bigger cynic by the way, Jonathan.
There you go. Alright, so give me an example, if there are any, of the UK winning a particular piece, a particular issue, and the EU winning a particular issue. I guess the latter is easier than the former.
It is. I guess the UK has capitulated on quite a lot. I think the final agreement is, people are saying it's probably about 90% of the very original EU guidelines that they put out last year. But I think, to be fair, the UK's made some ground. Mostly the ECJ is not there. There's talk of joint courts and joint bodies.
That's encouraging.
Which I think is, to be fair, I think is actually a pretty decent win on the whole. We'll stay under ECJ jurisdiction for the transition period. There's a few things not yet been ironed out. So, and actually future governance is one of them, isn't it? That's still to be worked through. There's not a great deal in it that's a big UK win, really.
I think there are positives within it, and you can definitely frame it that way. Unfortunately, there are massive caveats behind every single one of them, I think, is the unfortunate thing.
Like what?
There's broad agreement on some big issues. I mean, things like the financial settlement, we have agreement on. I think that was going around the news that we're going to be paying that until 2064.
2064, I think, is the last payment date the OBR's penciled in.
2064.
Which is essentially expected, I guess, when the last of our current employees at the European Union snuffs it and their pension scheme finally expires.
Yeah, citizens' rights, we have agreement on that. So, essentially, EU citizens in the UK EU citizens who come to the UK during the transition will have the same rights as EU citizens currently here.
Yep.
That's nice. That's a good move. The length of transition we have agreement upon, so it is going to go up until December the 31st.
2020.
2020, yeah.
So it's a bit shorter than the UK government wanted. The UK government really wanted it to run to the end of March 2021, but the EU has said no. So, and so, actually, yeah. that's very practical from the EU side, just for their whole accounting process. Essentially, their budget runs to the end of 2020, so
oh, see.
There'd be all sorts of additional faff, to be honest, if the UK stayed beyond then.
So on that night, there's going to be some, I would have thought, rapturous New Year's Eve celebrations from some groups of the population, and some really weird, weird vibes going on at some of the other New Year's Eve celebrations for the other half of the population.
Yeah, this is a strange one. I know it's not Brexit related in any way, shape or form. But what do we do when we leave? I mean, is this cause for a celebration? Well, some people presumably it is.
Well, for about half the country, yes, and for about half the country, no. I mean, I would have thought, you know, if Big Ben isn't fixed, then there will be very strong campaigns to make sure that the bell is available for the tolling of midnight.
It has to be marked in some way, and it can't all be negative. I mean, it'd be an awful thing if we go through all this process and actually... It's just quite a somber occasion, like a funeral or such a thing. A day of national mourning.
Yeah, and of course, and that's it. And of course, the thing is, a lot will change on the 1st of January 2021. We know the transition agreement keeps the status quo between now and then. The truth is, of course, what this doesn't tell us is we still have absolutely no idea what the world on the 1st of January 2021 is going to look like. That has yet to be flashed
out. This is one of the biggest issues with the whole thing, is that it's being called... They seem to be calling it a transition period. We still seem to be calling it an implementation period.
Well, is this not because Boris Johnson wants a transition period? But isn't this like one of the ministers wants to call one thing and therefore it has to be called something else?
There's a bit of rhetoric going on, but it all adds up to the same thing.
Yeah, none of it matters because it isn't a transition or an implementation period.
What is it?
It's just a standstill period.
It's an extension of the status quo,
We still won't know what we are transitioning to.
Well, that actually works... better, does it not? Because at least, I mean, in a transition period, we just take the rules. At least in a standstill, we get to make some of the rules.
No, we don't get to make any of the rules in a standstill. No.
Well, why not? Because I thought that would be the difference between extending Article 50 and the transition period.
No, extending Article 50 would have allowed us to keep our say in making all of the rules.
Yes.
What will happen here is we formally leave the European Union on the 29th of March next year. Which means we lose our MEPs,
right.
We lose our seat at the European Council, we lose our seat on all of the bodies that start to make EU law, but we are still party to all of that law.
So what's the difference between a standstill and a transition period? So we've got the difference between extending Article 50.
It can't be a transition period because we don't know where we're going at the end of it, if you take
yes,
what I mean.
We don't know what we're transitioning to.
Yeah.
All we're doing is extending the status quo, but taking our say away.
So I wonder if that actually this will form the basis of after the transition, whatever period it is.
If it does, I think a lot of Brexiteers are going to be quite angry.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they are at the minute for the reasons we've just outlined. But if this goes beyond 2021, and my guess is that it will.
My guess is it probably will as well.
Well, it's not a transition period. It's not an implementation period. So. If within that time frame we figure out what we are transitioning to or what we are implementing, it's a given that there will then need to be a period of implementation because we can't switch overnight to the new arrangement once it's been agreed. So it's going to go past 2021. I mean, and that's overlooking the fact that no one believes that this agreement can be drawn up
in this time
within the time frame that we've got.
So actually, it's the pre-transition phase.
Okay.
You could call it that.
That's not a bad... Yeah, copyright that. Yeah, we'll have that.
Pre-transition phase.
One of the scariest things is that there is no provision in the agreement whatsoever for extending it beyond 2021, which raises the significant possibility that towards the end of this period, we will have to ask the EU to extend it. And one of the points which I made is, if people think that our negotiating hand is weak now, wait until we get there.
Yeah, that's not a bad point.
Yeah.
Because we were one of the ones who actually put out a pretty positive press release, because this is a massively important political moment.
Yeah.
But the huge challenge is, it's kind of just kicked the can, because we don't know anymore. Because, of course, all this runs under the catchphrase of nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. we've still got the Northern Ireland border to deal with, which has not been dealt with in this yet. That's still got to be handled.
That seems to be completely shelved.
So the truth is, what we're really telling businesses is, you know, a few days ago, we had no idea what the world on the 29th of March next year was going to look like. We now do know what the 29th of March is going to look like provisionally, and our view is the world isn't really going to change until 2021. But there is still a risk that the world changes radically next March, because this has yet to be agreed. We've still got Northern Ireland borders to deal with. We've still got security to deal with.
Yep.
We've still got governance arrangements to deal with. And then it's going to get through the European Commission and through the Parliament and through the 27 Member States Parliaments and through the sub-national parliaments in those countries which have them. It's still got to do all of that. And a failure at any one of those stages means there is no deal.
So I was about to question if it does, because I was under the impression that the rules changed somewhat since then, but that's only regarding trade deals.
It's only specifically regarding trade. This is a primary treaty change, essentially.
Mm. Yeah.
So that could be a little bit of a sticking point.
Yeah, so essentially, there is still no cast iron certainty that everything will be okay on the 29th of March.
I do wonder if we're just going to lose a generation to this.
I mean, the politics. I mean, I think even with good luck and a following wind, this will be on politicians' desks for at least the next decade.
Yeah.
Probably more. Even with everything going perfectly to plan.
Uh-huh.
With politics getting in the way, you've another 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. So, you called me cynic before. Actually, I wonder if it's pretty good things about politicians tied up in something which is not us, actually.
Well, I mean, part of me thinks there is something positive in that. I like the idea of politicians having less time to legislate.
Yeah, completely.
And not changing stuff. The challenge is, stuff does need doing in the meantime. So what I would say is, you know, any other nation would handle this quite easily because their central government would be bogged down in foreign policy and local and regional government would carry on and run everything. But our local and regional government still doesn't have any powers. They're still massively hands tied behind the back by Whitehall. So actually, we still need Whitehall to do stuff. And I think that's the challenge.
How much more power would somewhere like Manchester or London need in order to implement the things that you would like them to implement?
Colossal. I mean, don't forget, local authorities' hands in this country are tied in many ways. The really big one is fiscally. So they can raise their council tax, but within pre-described bands that national governments set. They collect their business rates, but can do very little about what that money is spent. For everything else they need, Whitehall gives them a block grant, and they have zero powers beyond that to look after their own economic fortune. Now, that is incredible outlier in the whole of the rest of the developed world. So we're looking at local authorities having genuine, true autonomy over 5 or 10% of their budget at most. Most cities around the world would take 70 or 80 as a standard point.
Wow. So would you be looking at such stuff like raising actual income tax? Or having
local income tax, local sales tax, tourist taxes, all of those kind of things.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is quite a dramatic development.
It's a huge development, yeah. And even in the places with the most evolution, you know, London and Manchester, we're still a long, long way away from that.
Right, so you've got your list of the pros and cons there. You briefly touched on the pros. Anything more you'd like to say about the cons? Because that's the rest of your... Just to give the listeners an idea, Alex's piece of paper has about an inch worth of pros and then the rest of it is all cons.
Yeah, it's as I said at the beginning, there are positives, but there's caveats to all of them. So one of the big ones, which is being tossed around as a big win, is the fact that the EU is going to allow us to negotiate and ratify trade deals with third countries during the transition period.
Okay.
Those deals still won't be able to come into force until after the transition period, but they're happy for us to go and talk. But there's just, for me, this is just a total red herring, and there are big issues with the whole idea of it. First of all, there's no agreement in this as to what happens to the EU's current trade deals post-transition. That's still kind of up in the air.
We've got a footnote.
There's a footnote.
Yeah, so all of these issues. So 52 countries, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe even 53. I can't remember whether Canada's in the first batch or not. Plus another, 750?
Yep.
Bilateral treaties we're party to as part of being members of the EU. The EU is essentially saying the way we'll spin this is we'll ask all of the other signatories of those treaties to just pretend the UK is still in the EU for the next 21 months. the EU has no binding power to be able to make them do that. I don't know what else to say.
That's for the transition period. I was talking about afterwards.
Yes, exactly.
Even for the transition period, there's no, as I see it, there's no legal backing to that position. I mean, have South Korea and Canada been consulted as to whether they want, you know, they want those things to...
So, I mean, South Korea has already raised an issue about that, as has one of the South American countries, I can't remember which.
Because
essentially, as we said, you know, Britain is in its weakest negotiating position it has been in a couple of centuries in terms of international trade. You know, as one of those countries, depending on which way your trade flows are, you'd kind of be mad not to try and take the opportunity to strengthen that in your favour somewhat.
Do you know what these objections are? Or do you just know that they've objected about something?
I just know they've objected. One of them was around quotas. So this is a big one, of course. So people have talked about the free trade agreements from a tariffs point of view. The tariffs are all so close to zero in most of these now. With the exception of little bits of the economy, they're broadly irrelevant. The big challenge will be on quotas. So quotas are usually on the basis of you can import... Let's imagine in the EU's... common commercial policy in the customs union, you can import, you know, first 100,000 tons of beef at zero duty, second 200,000 tons at 5%, and then it's, you know, a huge number after that. The question becomes, what share of that 100,000 tons that can go into the EU is the UK's share, and what share is the EU's share? And each country each third country will have its own view on what that should be.
How do they do it now?
They do it now very, very slowly. So it is only last year that the revised schedules of the EU from the accession of the Eastern European states in 2004 were finally ratified.
Okay.
It took 13 years to agree the new schedules for the imports into the A8.
Hang on. Let me understand this. So if there's, say, a beef... if there are beef imports, how do they measure where it's come from, and does that matter?
So it's all measured. It's all caught in the. This is what customs borders are for, essentially.
Yeah.
So you know where everything comes from. So from the UK and the EU side, you could very easily say we'll take the last 3 years worth of imports of each of these, average them out, and we'll split them like that. But that's across the block. That's across everything coming into the EU.
Yeah.
What you will more probably have is countries like, say, Brazil or New Zealand, who are big exporters of, say, meat to the European market. One of them might say, well, OK, you're saying, you know, the UK was responsible for, I don't know, 15% of all EU imports, so that's the quota they get. New Zealand might say, yeah, but we provided 90% of the UK's import of our New Zealand lamb. Or Brazil might say, well, actually, we use the entire EU quota sending our beef to Britain.
See.
All of a sudden, those countries see duty-free trade into the UK and the EU compromised from what they've had before. And they may well want to raise objections.
Right.
How all that pans out, we've yet to see. But that's just sort of just one little glimpse into a very complicated area. Mm-hmm.
So do you expect this to be replicated many, many times then?
Right. This is the big challenge. So we're in the process of replicating our WTO schedules. So we just cut and paste as much of the EU as we can.
It does seem absurd. I mean, this is just me being naive to trade. But it does seem absurd to me that I want to sell you beef. You want to buy a beef, but Alex has to make a note of it and record it all in and record it all out.
Yeah,
and maybe take some cash.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's just the way international trade works.
You don't have to within the EU.
Yep. You just put it in a box and stick it on a wagon, and it's done. No, that's it. The world is complicated, and that's one of the big things. You know, we've kept coming back to this podcast series. The problem is the world generally is having its eyes opened. The UK side, particularly, just to how complex trade is, and the regulations are. But in many ways, it's the world of the world kind of post WTO and EU and regulation has got incredibly complex to be able to facilitate trade easily. The complexity actually makes getting stuff over borders easier than it was before.
It reminds me of when someone introduces some sort of invasive species into a food chain, and then you've got to find something else to eat the invasive species, and then we'll have more and more things, and eventually it all crumbles. But they actually seem to have introduce so many invasive species, it somehow works.
Somehow, yeah. The world of trade is complicated, let's say that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm pretty sure I got this from Alex's Twitter, because I get most of my Brexit stuff from Alex's Twitter.
Yes.
Was there something which you tweeted the other week about the UK preparing basically a customless border? So one of the options was...
Yes.
Yeah. Can you explain this in more detail?
I don't remember what this was.
This was a story which came out, I think it was earlier this week, might have been over the weekend, and basically someone in government had suggested that the way they could solve the Northern Ireland border and, oh that's it, they would make sure there wouldn't be any queues at Dover or Calais, for a border is two-sided, because we would simply not implement a customs border at all.
Oh yeah, yeah, right.
Now this has so many holes in it,
right.
It's hard to know where to start.
I mean, okay, so... First of all, is this a serious suggestion? Is it actually on the table?
It can't be.
It's against
the law, yes. So it would break WTO rules.
Okay.
So you are required to have a customs border to protect areas. Either way, whatever we decide, the EU will erect a customs border around its customs union.
Right.
That will happen anyway. So kind of you saying I'm not going to have one on the other side doesn't actually matter because... Every line has two sides.
Yeah,
so
he's all still in the room, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you got all that. So yeah, secondly, it's against WTO rules. Thirdly, we can't. It would stop us doing any free trade deals of any meaningful sort with any other country because to go to Mexico and say we're going to give you zero tariffs, zero quotas, bring in whatever you like. To be able to do that, we'd need to know that crate has come from Mexico.
Would we?
Well, you wouldn't without a customs border.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't need to.
And I was saying, why would we want to do a trade deal? We can just put it through that border that you're not enforcing.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
To be honest, it makes things a lot easier. I mean, there's no more deals.
Yeah,
the consumer wins-ish.
Yeah, and the UK spends most of the next decade in disputes at the WTO court, which, again, we talked about this before, the messaging from the UK, when it talks about we're ready for the deal, oh, we're not ready for the deal, it's signed well, it's politically agreed, and there's... All of this conversation is going on publicly in front of countries with whom we are about to try and open some major international treaties. And anything which sort of just makes you look a bit of a wally in all of this is not a good way of... sort of setting yourself ready to go out into the brave world.
That is true, but we don't really help ourselves. I mean, you know, regardless of what the politicians do or not, one of the sides, whether it be the Brexiteers or the Remainers, are always going to kick up a fuss. No one is going to be completely satisfied.
Oh no,
which is the problem with our negotiating position.
Yeah, but I don't have a problem with Brexiteers or Remainers or, you know, varying bits of the public holding different opinions. The fact when you've got your major four officers of state who can't agree, that is a problem. That is a really big problem. Who are we negotiating with, you know, and what is our negotiating stance, is stuff we talked about before.
It just baffles me the things that people say, and they say them as if the rest of the world can't see that we're saying it. And we've said this multiple times with the whole no deal is better than a bad deal thing, that a bluff doesn't work if the other side can see that you're bluffing. And then the best... A prime example of this, this was a few weeks ago, I think it was Liz Truss, tweeted... no deal is better than a bad deal. And then she replied to her own tweet saying, and by saying that, we can secure the best deal for Britain. And I was like, so you've just bluffed and then replied to yourself saying, that's a bluff, and by using that bluff, we're going to get a good... Like, they can see both of those tweets. they can see both of them, so it doesn't work, does it?
It is staggering, actually, how ill-equipped MPs are for this sort of negotiation. For all the other things that they are good at, and I'm not completely down on MPs, how ill-equipped they are for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. There's a colossal knowledge gap. And, I mean, I think some of this goes back... I mean, the phishing stuff, actually, you know, phishing came back into the headlines again this week. We talked about it last week, so we won't revisit it in a lot of detail. But it's the whole thing about, you know, we've not had an independent trade policy for, you know, 40-odd years now. Everybody... Well, first of all, most people in Parliament don't remember the world when we did have control of our own trade. But it appears that the only examples they've got of how things work is in us in a pre-EU situation, but also pre-WTO, pre-GATT, and they're trying to reverse back to that world. We see that a bit with the fisheries. So, I understand entirely there are communities for whom fisheries are colossally important in the way that, you know, mines were important to particular areas in the north many years ago. But the world's moved on. Mm. The world's moved on, and you can't unscramble the egg. You know, you can't take the cake apart into its constituent bits again. So we are where we are. You need to deal with the world as it is today, not as how you remember it being in the 70s or in some kind of way. And so much of that rhetoric from the, you know, from the hard Brexiteers, from the Rees-Moggs, has been about that. You know, oh, we can just, you know, we don't need a customs border with Ireland because we didn't have one before we joined the EU. It's like, well, no, we didn't. But we, the point is, we did join the EU at the same time, and we erected a common customs border around ourselves. So you can't undo that now. Or at least you can't undo that on your own, because all of that was taken with joint decisions with Ireland.
The
omelette can't be made back into eggs again. So we've got to work with that. And the fisheries is a good one of those. People said, you know, well, you know, if we got back control of our waters, we could double, quadruple, you know, quintuple the size of fishing to the UK economy. But that would take it from 0.05% of UK GDP to some other number that's larger but still essentially irrelevant.
Just basically a rounding error.
Yeah, and of course that's a very hard, I understand it's a very hard thing for anyone in the fishing industry to hear, but you know, one of the things I think we've talked about before in this, now we have, you know, you've cried, the UK has clearly cried to have sovereign control and to have decisions. Well, now it needs to start taking them and understanding that in trade, as in all economic stuff, there are trade-offs. You've got to decide, you're going to give a little bit here to win a bit here. Now, what is it important that you win? Because the truth is, the next 50 or 100 years strength in the UK economy, and even in those little towns around the UK, is not going to be re-won with the fishing industry. You know, are we going to trade off pharmaceutical regulations in favour of fishing? That would be a very bad move.
Yeah.
Are we going to trade off financial services to have access over our own fishing waters? That, whilst I suspect lots of the British public would say, yay, let's get rid of the bankers, is not going to be any good for the UK in the long term.
Yeah, now, financial services has come up in this, and it's not a particularly great deal.
Well, it's not in the deal at all, I don't think.
I think is this something today?
Yeah.
There
is
not in the FT today.
There is, that it looks like they might soften up a bit on financial services.
Okay.
So initially, yeah, it's not in the deal at all. I think they want to keep it as very, very simply part of the single market and not including. People say financial services are in CETA. Not in any meaningful sense, they're not.
No, just on financial services, is there any element from the EU? Now, I know they want to get as much financial services out of London, and they do anyway. I mean, even if we were members, they'd like to get
absolutely, yeah. France, Germany, Netherlands, Ireland, are all absolutely chomping for that.
Is there any element of it where they think, actually, maybe we should go easy because they do a lot of things which we don't have the capacity to do there, at least in the short term?
Alex shrugs, so I'll have a go. I think so. I think there is. So, I mean, the big one that always comes back to is things like euro bond clearing, which takes place, you know, I think like 90% of global euro clearing takes place in the UK. People have said that the EU says it should happen only within EU member state territory. Maybe not. The challenge is how on earth you move that sheer volume of trade that fast. So I think there is an acknowledgement that they would love to grab it. Of course they would. And again, I think this is a realisation that the UK government is only slowly coming to, that the EU's role in this negotiation is to get the best possible deal it can for EU member states.
Yeah.
Of course it is. As in our role. It's not... Because they've said, oh, it's in their interest to look after us. It's like, they will look after us, providing they can look after themselves as well. But if it comes to a crunch, they will prioritise... you know, the health of the EU, of course they will. As you said, Frankfurt, Paris, Dublin all want a big share of UK financial services.
I'll give you another example. It wasn't so long ago that, banks still are in the bad books, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, bankers' taxes or bankers' bonus taxes and all the rest of it. I think it was Barclays that were threatening to move elsewhere. And the problem that they had is no one really wanted them. I mean, they did want them, but the complexities of re-headquartering a head bank and then getting enough regulators in. I mean, you've got to have a whole new team to regulate an HSBC or a Barclays. It's not easy.
No, exactly. And this is one of the UK's, you know, utter successes. You know, whatever your own feelings are on, you know, financial services and the banking sector, the UK is globally leading at this. You know, New York could nip at our heels, but not much more than nip. And the third closest, number three in that list, is way behind. So, I mean, there is no obvious global. There is nowhere where London's financial institutions could just up and go to.
Yeah.
Because of that wider infrastructure. I think there's also wide societal stuff. So, you know, we in the north might grumble about London, but it is one of the most desirable cities on earth. Frankfurt is a lovely place, but it's not the kind of place that you see the great global jet set going and moving to and living in.
Yeah, that is true.
You know, sorry if there are any German people listening from Frankfurt. It's a beautiful place, but it's not got that kind of global cachet. Paris has some of that, but it's also got much higher taxes.
I don't mind saying that. I don't mind saying this publicly either. I've been to Paris, it's dreadful.
Well, that may be dreadful. Your opinion. I rather like Paris. I'd happily move to Paris, but I think the point is most people in financial services wouldn't. I would. Like the Parisians.
I would suggest if it was to make a proper run at the banking industry, I'd probably relocate it to Barcelona or somewhere.
Oh, or Barcelona. But I mean, I think probably the one to look for in the short term is probably a place like Dublin. Where there are substantial settlements already there. The population is highly skilled, very attractive corporate tax rates.
And what's the language then?
Common language, and you could commute it from London.
Yes, absolutely. Right, that was pretty comprehensive. Anyone else wants to add about anything?
I just continue moaning for a bit.
It does kind of feel like that at the moment, and which part of me thinks is a bit of a shame because this is a big thing we've got through this week. We've got there, as you joked earlier, but quite rightly, saying by mostly capitulating on everything. The big challenge is there's much more to be done though, and the Northern Irish border is still the light that kind of screams because everything else you can. On everything else, you can see the UK government capitulating with little domestic political effects.
Yeah.
So the challenge of some form of, you know, European-led court, if push comes to shove, it'll bottle it, and actually, the hot Brexiteers will scream, but it's not going to cause the dissolution of the Tory party or anything else. The DUP have been happy to go along so far with the wording in this agreement saying, well, you know, we understand that it's the backstop. So listeners, just cast your mind back. So there is a backstop clause in here which says if the UK and the EU cannot find alternative methods of ensuring absolutely no border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, then Northern Ireland will remain inside the customs union and within the single market for goods. That would create a hard customs border between mainland UK and the Republic and Northern Ireland, or it would involve the whole of the UK remaining in the single market for goods and the customs union. This is something that cannot be fudged without significant political collateral.
Yeah, we go back to the red lines, don't we?
Yeah.
Some of the red lines have to fall for any other solution to work, essentially. And that's again just been kicked down the road.
Because this kind of the backstop option is option number three. Number one is you find some way of doing it within the FTA. Number two is you get magical unicorn rainbow glittered bloody drones to scan everyone's barcode. The truth is, absolutely everybody, including the companies who deal with all this kind of stuff, say one and two are not going to happen.
Yeah,
it is just not plausible.
There was another thing which I saw. So a report has been done. I can't remember who's done by, but HMRC have had some involvement with it, and the Cabinet have seen it, mm-hmm. saying that there is simply no border on Earth. Where this would work. There's no precedent for making this kind of thing work like this anywhere. And you know, all the people tell us that even if we do figure out a system for making it work, it would take beyond 2021 to implement that system in order for it to work anyway. It just goes back to the point that this is good in terms of political progress, and you know, it is a good thing that we've got this agreement, but none of it still really translates into real implementation of Brexit, or in a legalistic sense. Tying Brexit down, what Brexit actually looks like. None of that has really moved forward. And this is the issue when we're dealing with businesses and trying to represent the voice of business. You know, how long have we been saying that businesses might be forced into making contingency plans based upon the worst case scenario? This hasn't made that decision any easier for them because it's a provisional agreement. There are loads of things that could bring it down. There are loads of reasons why 2021 might become 2025. And then if you're a business that's having to make plans now as to how you're going to plan for the future, do you do it based on a political agreement, or do you do it based on a legal certainty? And if you do it on the second one, your only option is still to plan for the worst case scenario.
Absolutely, no, very well put.
So actually, it makes the decision easier. It just doesn't make it any less painful.
It's progress, but in reality, I'm not sure how much it changes anything.
Yeah, we don't have any legal progress.
Yeah,
that's the point. Yeah, legally, we are still at the point where no deal on the 29th of March is possible.
Well, having listened to you both talk and weighed up the pros and cons of everything which you've said, I think I'd select the no border option completely. But that's just my opinion.
it's illegality doesn't concern you.
Yes,
no, exactly.
Details. I'll get someone else to work that out. Well, thank you very much as always. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, Christian is at?
I am currently at GMCC_Christian.
Currently. We'll come back to that. And you, Alex?
I'm at GMCC_Alex, and I will be for a while.
I am at J Beardmore indefinitely. So, yes, until next week, from me, Christian, Alex, goodbye.